Hello and welcome to SciLax, the podcast where we talk about scientific developments and technological changes in Luxembourg. And in today's episode, we have a guest who is Kathleen Mometz, the Biospecimen Science Assistant Scientist at LIHSO Luxembourg Institute of Health. Kathleen holds a PhD in biology, and she recently received the Rosalind Franklin Society Award in Science for her article published in the journal Biopreservation and Biobanking. Kathleen, thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so once again, we're recording in the field. We are in your home, so I'm always very excited to see how the scientists work from home and what they have around. So if you're hearing any background noise or whatever, this is what you normally deal with at home when you work here. And I'm really happy you're hosting us here. But of course, we need to focus on science and not where we are. So let's go straight into that. And I mentioned already quite a few words that I have problems with. And we will start with the first one, biobank. So what is a biobank?
So a biobank is like a bank, but a bank would store money and a biobank would store biospecimens. So there are different types, and the most common one are blood, urine, saliva. There is tissue also. It's a word that came up in 1996. And since that moment, when the first biobank existed, there has been a lot more biobanks.
So when you say it's like a bank, does it mean that you also have like loads of security checks in order to get in or not?
There are some security checks, but not like in a bank. No. I don't think people would like to come and steal some urine in our laboratories.
Who knows? I mean, I don't want to go that path, but people are interested in lots of different things. So maybe there's a scientist that wants to have a lot of samples. And then, no, I'm not giving ideas to scientists here. Okay, so we said biobank, and then in Luxembourg, we have IBBL, right? And that's a biobank.
So IBBL is the Integrated Biobank of Luxembourg. And yes, that's the biobank of Luxembourg.
How many specimens does it store? Do you know the recent data?
Yes, I can give some collection statistics. So in 2022, IBBL, the Luxembourgish biobank, collected sample and created 3 million aliquots. And in 2022, 219,061 samples were distributed to our partners, to the researchers, to the clinicians.
So when it's based in Luxembourg, does it mean that the samples, the researchers, clinicians have to be based in Luxembourg as well to use it? Or do you also distribute abroad?
So we distribute abroad and we also collect from abroad, but mainly we collect from Luxembourg.
All right. So we know a little bit about the biobank. And I think actually, atypically, before we reveal the answer, I would actually already ask you to tell us what your pub quiz question is, because I have a feeling that this is the right moment. We're just introducing our listeners to the general idea of biobanks. So what is your question? And of course, listeners, remember the answer will be only at the end of the podcast.
So like I said, I work in the Integrated Biobank of Luxembourg, which is part of the Luxembourg Institute of Health. If we were a normal bank, we would store money, but as we are a biobank, we store biospecimens for research into diseases like cancer. Common biospecimen types are blood, urine, and tissue. My question is the following. Which of the following more unusual biospecimen types are not stored at our biobank? Saliva, hair, sweat, fecal samples, nasal swabs, gastric content, or breast milk?
So if you want to steal one of those things, you can't steal, going back to the discussion we had before. Remember, it's not about what is there, but what is not, and it's one of them, right?
Exactly.
Answer only at the end of the podcast. And now we go back to the discussion. So you said you have different specimens that you store there. What are the conditions? Is it very cold in there or not?
So we store at different temperature. We can store at room temperature, at 4 degrees, at minus 20, at minus 80, or in liquid nitrogen, which would be very cold, around minus 196 degrees.
So a lot of different options. And then what does it depend on? I guess the specimen has certain requirements.
So it depends on the specimen, and it depends also on the use of the specimen, depending on what the researcher will do with the specimens, because we try to provide specimen with the best quality, But depending on the research, sometimes a standard quality is more than enough, but sometimes you really have to have very specific quality, and there it requires special conditions.
Okay, so walk me through the steps, actually, because you said, okay, it depends what the researcher requires. So does it mean that you collect the sample and then you check who might be interested? Or it actually starts with the researcher saying like, oh, I will need these samples, and then you start preparing it?
The two cases are possible. We have huge collections, which are standard, which are typically, for example, in neurodegenerative disease here in our IBBL, but there is also clinicians or researchers that come to us and tell us, we would like to set up research. Can you organize this for us?
But then, isn't there a problem? I mean, I'm looking obviously from my own perspective of having done loads of surveys and questionnaires and trying to have participants. How does it work if a researcher says like, oh, I need, I don't know, 20,000. I'm just giving a number. I have no idea how many. We'll talk about it later. I need 20,000 skin samples or whatever. Skin samples? No, that's too much. Blood samples, better. How do you actually manage to convince all the people to give that blood?
So there are different parts. We work with nurses and clinicians, and depending on the nurse or the clinician, they will explain to the patient or the healthy donors. It's not only patient. Healthy donors are very important too. They will explain the use and why they should participate in such studies. And it's depending on the specimen type. Some are really easy to give, such as urine, which are not invasive, but some are a bit more invasive. And then it's more on a case-by-case basis. But in every case, I can tell you there is always a patient on the healthy controls will sign an informed consent, making sure that he knows why he's giving sample and how we will use the sample.
Of course, but it's also anonymized, I guess. It's, you don't care that it's from this person. Most probably you care about maybe some underlying conditions, but not necessarily the person itself and where they live, right?
At the biobank, we have absolutely no contact with the patient or the healthy controls, and all the samples that come in are anonymized.
So, sample preparation process. So I understand you have the researchers saying like, oh, I want to study this, and then you start preparing, or you actually start collecting the samples. And what do? You contact nurses, you contact clinicians, they collect the samples for you. And then they ship them by one of the shipping companies? I guess not.
Yes, no, yes. It's exactly that.
Okay.
So let's give an example. I think it will be easier. I work a lot with Parkinson's disease. And so there is the Parkinson's clinic at the CHL. So the clinician will meet with a patient, explain a study they want to do. And then the patient will give a sample. Let's say, for example, a skin biopsy. So the skin biopsy will be collected by the clinician, and then transporter, it can be Marken or another one, will send it to the biobank. So we will receive the skin biopsy, and then we will take it in our lab and we will process the skin biopsy. And in my example, when we receive skin biopsy, we want to isolate specific type of cells, skin cells that are called fibroblasts. And these will be put in culture. And after some time, those fibroblasts will be ready and we will ship them to researchers, typically at the University of Luxembourg, which will use those fibroblasts to create stem cells. And from those stem cells, they will create brain organoids and they will study Parkinson's disease in a lab, in a dish, where they will really look at the lab version of the brain of the patient, which gave the sample initially.
So there's a lot of shipping involved.
There is a lot of shipping involved.
It's important, you know, I was thinking about, we don't send letters to each other anymore, but the shipping companies are also important in research in that particular case. So it's good to remember about them when we see them next time. But then this means that there's no research done at IBBL. Per se, it's just storing the samples?
So the main role of a biobank is processing sample. So there we have really standard procedure and everything is done so that to erase the variability. But there is a small research team, so this is my team, which does biospecimen research. And when we say that we do biospecimen research, we want to make sure that the biospecimen we provide researchers has the best quality. To explain biospecimen research science, I will give an example. There was a study published in 2006 stating that they had discovered a biomarker for multiple sclerosis. So they use cerebrospinal fluid, so that's a specific type of sample from patient and healthy controls. And they were able to separate the patient having multiple sclerosis from the controls with an absolute specificity. It was amazing. But then they realized that the sample had been collected in two different institutes. And one institute had stored sample at minus 20, while the other one had stored the sample at minus 80. And so the difference that they were seeing was not actually linked with the disease, but was linked with the storage condition. And so the marker was not useful for the disease. And this is really a very good example of what is biospecimen research. We want to make sure that we are studying the disease and not studying other variability, in this case, the pre-analytical variability.
Extremely important, because when we talk about specimen, when we talk about samples, we say, oh, contamination. But it's not only contamination. There's just so much. Here we're talking just the temperature that could create differences.
In this case, yes, it was only the storage temperature that generate these changes in a specific protein. But yeah, this was the issue.
Extremely important for all the researchers doing any biomedical research, for sure. But when you were talking, you mentioned a few, you know, kind of red zones for me. So some terms that I'm not so sure about. And the first one, we keep talking about it, and I still want a definition because I'm not sure I understand. You said they found a biomarker. What is a biomarker? Are you able to explain it? It seems super complicated to me.
No, it's easy. So in today's society with an aging population, we need more effective tools to detect disease. And these tools, superhero tools, are called biomarkers. So they can have different function. For instance, they can distinguish healthy subject from sick patient, or they can detect the stages of a disease. And here I will give a common example that I think everybody knows of useful clinical biomarkers. And these are, for example, the glucose levels in diabetes or cholesterol levels in cardiovascular disease. And discovering biomarkers requires a lot of biospecimen of appropriate quality.
Okay, so it's basically certain values.
It can be a molecule, a protein, it can be a cell, it can it's anything.
Anything that shows differences.
Yes.
More or less. I mean, I'm very much simplifying it, but I understand. Yeah, I have a feeling that this is a term that is just used so much. And sometimes I was not sure whether I understood it correctly or not, but it's kind of like a very, very broad term to actually show difference, as you said, different protein, different cell, different whatever else that tells us, okay, this is probably some change that we could associate with certain disease or lack of disease or anything else. Okay, I think I got it. I hope our listeners did too. Okay, and then you said variability. So what about variability?
Yeah, it's true. I introduce a lot of specific terms. So there are different types of variability that can influence the results of biological tests. And there is inter-individual. So that's the difference between different individuals. So you and me, we are not the same. There is also intra-individual variability. So within your own body, if you collect blood in the arm or if you collect blood in another place, there might be difference in the blood itself. Then there is analytical variability, and this is depending on which machine, for example, you would use to analyze the blood. It might give similar but not exactly the same results. And then there is the pre-analytical variability, which is really the variability that interests me.
And why does it interest you?
It is defined as any variation occurring between the moment of sample collection and the moment of sample analysis. So pre-analytical variability is not associated to innate disease or sample variation. And that's why it interests me, because I want that researchers have samples that are meaningful, that they can do real research linked with disease. And if there is a difference linked with another type of variability,
Well, it would be a waste of time. It would be a waste of sample. So that's why I'm so interested.
But then how do you know? I mean, it's like so many different conditions we need to take into consideration, right? Do you have like a list of things that actually the pre-analytical variability is composed of? Okay, is the temperature something like that or not?
Let's talk about blood.
Yes.
There would be the temperature, but there would be the temperature of collection, the temperature of storage. There would be the delay between the collection and the processing. There would be the question of how is the processing performed. Yes, there are a lot of different things that we have to consider. And when we analyze them, we select based on publication, based on our innate feeling, what we think would be the condition to analyze.
And when a researcher has a sample collected by you, and then they get it for their research, what is the typical time, because you just mentioned this is one of the important factors, between sample collection and research done? Can you also say about an average, how much time is between? Because you said it can influence actually the results, right?
Yeah, sorry. No, it's not clear. So the time is not between the moment when the researchers will have the sample.
Okay.
It's the moment when the sample is collected and the sample is stored. So I mentioned different temperature, mm-hmm. and we actually store samples so that they stop degrading. And so it's really the moment we collect. So it's taken out from the patient, and the moment this sample has been stored, frozen, placed in liquid nitrogen, and that we can make sure that there will not be any degradation, not any variation induced in the sample.
So what's the common practice? Let's say a clinician collects a sample and sends them to you. How much time and what are the conditions? Are they always the same or do they adjust actually to what you request?
Oh, these are really difficult questions. So it will really depend on the type of specimen and on the use of the specimen. So if we are talking about a researcher that wants to do a study about a protein found in blood, and we know this protein degrades within 2 hours if the sample is kept at room temperature. In this case, of course, the shipment will be done very quickly and there will be pressure so that the sample is processed and stored as quickly as possible. But sometimes researchers, they are working with another protein, which is very stable, even if kept at room temperature for a long time. In this case, we would not have this hurry of processing and storing the sample within a certain time limit.
Okay, so then that means that actually what interests you in your research is very much dependent on so many different factors. So you can't overgeneralize, can you? It's very much, okay, blood sample for this type of study needs to be in this temperature and that time of, you know, pre-processing or transport or whatever else. You can't say, okay, normally when we collect samples, we need to get them within this time and they should be, collected in these type of conditions. It's very much, okay, these samples are like that and these are completely different. You can't have recommendations in general.
We do have recommendations. For example, for tissue such as skin biopsy, we know that a piece of tissue is quite big. It will not degrade quickly. So if you process it within 4 hours at room temperature, you are well within range. Same with blood. Typically, when researchers are working with plasma or serums, they are looking at proteins that we know would not degrade within the next 2-4 hours at room temperature. But there is always, of course, specific case, and then we take it one by one.
Nowadays, there is a tendency of actually growing things, as I would say, artificially, right? So you have all these organoids, organ-like things. So it's not a specimen you're collecting from a person, let's put it this way. Do you think this means that biobanks will cease to exist at a certain moment? We'll not be collecting real samples anymore? We'll be just growing everything in the lab as it goes or not?
So that's a good question, but actually to generate organoids, you need cells. And those cells always come from a sample, which comes from a patient or a controlled or healthy control. So no, you will always need biobanks. You will need patient participation.
Okay, good. I'm happy to hear that because it's also good for you and for your future, right? But talking of you and your future and everything, I just realized that I said, oh, you work at LIH. And then we just switched quickly into IBBL and was like, wait, so is it LIH? Is it IBBL? Can we explain to listeners what's going on here? These are not two separate institutions anymore.
No, the Integrated Biobank of Luxembourg has been merged within the Luxembourg Institute of Health, LIH. It's true, I always talk about IBBL because that's where I started to work 10 years ago. But now IBBL is really integrated into the LIH, the Luxembourg Institute of Health.
So we also cleared that up. It's clear right now, so people don't think like, okay, well, what is she talking about? Where does she work, really? I wanted to actually now touch upon what we discussed in the introduction to our interview today. So the award you got, because I have to say that there was a choice of mine not to tell what the article was titled, because that's already that moment when maybe some listeners would say, okay, I'm going to listen to something else. It's very complicated. Kudos to you that you are able to write such articles and you understand what they are about, because it's really completely, for me, rocket science, I could say. But for sure, you're able to explain to us, what was the research about? What did you write about? What are we talking about here?
This award I received from the article talks about skin biopsies, skin cells, and stem cells. I think I have to give the journey of a fibroblast. So the fibroblast is a skin cell. It all starts in a patient who has a skin. Then we make a skin biopsy from it. And from the skin biopsy, we can isolate cells, skin cells called fibroblasts. And then those fibroblasts can be placed in culture, expanded. And when we have a sufficient quantity, we can reprogram them in stem cells. So this is really crazy technique, I will say, where a mature cell such as the skin cells, the fibroblast, becomes again a stem cell. And with these induced pluripotent stem cells, that's the name of those specific type, you can generate theoretically any type of cells you would be interested in. And so researchers at the University of Luxembourg are using those induced pluripotent stem cell to generate brain organs.
What's the added value of creating stem cells? Why do we need them, actually? Why are we so excited? Yeah, we can have them from a skin biopsy.
So maybe I will start by explaining what are stem cells. So these are immature cells, so unspecialized cells that can grow indefinitely and can give rise to any other types of cells in the body. So it really goes against our former belief that we can go only one way with the developmental cells. So going from immature to mature cells. Now we are going backwards in time and we are going from mature cells to immature cells. But when you work with patients, for example, always Parkinson's disease, you would like to know what is happening in the brain because that's where the disease actually happens. But you cannot have access to brain cells so easily. And that's where stem cells are so useful because you can use them and generate neurons, for example, neurons that will actually have the same disease than the patient, that will really mimic what is happening in the brain of the patient, a live patient.
But then you can't really easily put them back in, right? That's the problem. So you can generate them, but the problem is that, like, you can't put neurons back in the brain, can you?
Yes, you can. It has been tried. Okay. It has been tried in Parkinson's disease, where they had generated a new neurons and they placed it back in the brain of patient, believing that since the disease is linked to the degeneration of specific neurons, by placing back new neurons in the brain, the patient would no more have the disease. And what actually happens is that with time, the new neurons that were placed in the brain started to degrade as well.
So we are not there yet, really.
Well, the research is moving on and we hope to find a cure one day, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also great that we're talking about it in Luxembourg, right? Because there's a lot of research going on. And I also interviewed Ibrahim Boussard talking about their research too. So if you're interested more in that subject, do listen to the episode. I personally enjoyed it a lot. So I hope our listeners will as well. But I actually interrupted you. You were explaining your, you know, the article and your research. And then I said, okay, so tell me what is stem cell and tell me that and whatever.
So I've explained, I think, the logical route or journey of a fibroblast. So going from patient, skin cell, fibroblast, induced pluripotent stem cells, and then organoids. And my article was really focused on the moment where we obtain skin biopsies and we go to iPS induced pluripotent stem cells. Because when you have a tissue, there are different ways that you can obtain fibroblasts. So there is enzymatic digestion, there is a physical separation, or there are a combination of both. And I just wanted to check the variability induced by those different techniques. So I use the same huge skin biopsy and I try different conditions. I obtain fibroblasts, and then from those fibroblasts, I generated induced pluripotent stem cells, and I always check the quality of those cells, and I was able to tell which of those techniques is the most optimal.
And we know now.
And we know now.
You're sure now. So what's the best technique?
In our biobank, we use a physical separation. So we receive a small skin biopsy. And from this small skin biopsy, we cut it in typically 5 to 7 pieces that we put in culture. So the cells will grow out of those small tissue pieces. And then we will freeze it with a specific cryopreservative.
You're saying that the physical separation is the best when it comes to the quality of the sample.
In order to generate iPSC, yes.
Yes, okay. Because this means that the sample you're getting, just summarizing what I understood, the sample you're getting is a sample that will not be more variable than the others. Can
exactly.
we say it like that?
Okay. Yes.
All
it
right.
It will grow well. It will grow normally always the same way. It will give rise to your stem cells as you would like it to be. We've also tested it in culture with skin biopsies coming from different type of patient, young, old patient, patient with disease, patient without disease, and it's really our optimal condition.
How do you know, oh, we've created a stem cell? Oh, this is not a stem cell yet. What are the characteristics?
So they are physical characteristics. Fibroblast will be a cell that is really elongated, where the stem cell is a very small cell with a huge nucleus inside. So visually you can tell. And stem cells, they will grow in colonies. So you really have a spot of cells that are your stem cells. Then, of course, you can do a lot of different techniques to make sure that you have the correct cells. You can do immunofluorescence where you use antibodies. There are so many different things. But the first step is visually, you can already see it.
So it's something that actually a non-trained eye would also notice the difference, or you have to be really trained in this?
Maybe not in the first stage when the stem cells are induced, but once they have formed colonies, anybody can see it. Yeah.
Okay, good. Interesting, you know, also for those people who want to pursue that career. And it's nice because I have always this feeling that you're doing it at such a level that for us normal human beings, there's just like no entry level thing. It's just so complicated altogether. So we talked about stem cells, we talked about your article and all that. But what about genome and genes? Is there something related here? Genome stability, what's that? And why are you also talking about it?
When you process a sample, any type of sample, you can, like I said, induce variability. In the case of fibroblast and stem cells, where the genome is so important, so the gene of the cells, it is important to make sure that you don't induce any genome modification due to the process. So there are a lot of different types of genome modification. They can be very small one, or they can be big one where, I don't know, a chromosome would be altered. In my study, I also make sure that by using those different dissociation technique, I would not induce any genome modification link with the technique.
Wait a second. So if I get the skin from someone and then I create a stem cell from that. Still trying simple terms. What will be the genome there? It will be the genome of the donor?
Yes.
Fully?
It would be the genome of the donor. Well, that's what you hope to achieve.
Okay. And that's what we are talking here about, that if there is a different method, you could actually somehow modify the genome.
Exactly.
Okay. But you might want to modify it or not.
Some people want, yes, to induce genome modification. But in my case, it's exactly what I didn't want to happen. I wanted it to remain as stable as possible.
And there is also another term that I noticed that you talked about, maybe even today, if not definitely in the article or somewhere else where I was reading about your work, reprogramming a stem cell. So reprogramming a stem cell is not changing the genome of the stem cell. That's something else.
Reprogramming is really the process of going from a mature cells back to the stem cell stage.
Ah, okay. So reprogramming is not changing the stem cells, is actually achieving the stem cells from the mature cells.
Yes, the reprogramming process is really going from a mature cells to a stem cells, but then from a stem cells, if you want to obtain again another type of mature cells, this is called differentiation. Okay. So these are two different things.
Okay, cool. So we have a lot of terms today. I hope that our listeners will just have a collection and say, like, I understand now what the scientists are talking about. Because it's, you know, sometimes you actually say, but you could have just said growing or whatever else. But yes, I know that science also, it's important to be precise with the terms sometimes. And I was just thinking, you know, today when we were talking about different specimens, we said blood, we said skin. But I also noticed that there is another fluid we did not mention, which is the cerebrospinal fluid. It is something that the biobank collects. And my question is, why? What do you do with it? And what is it used for?
So cerebrospinal fluid is a liquid that is in nearly direct contact with the brain. So it has an interest in any types of neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's disease. And it's true, we collect it, not so much, but we do.
Is it difficult to collect such a sample?
It's a more invasive procedure. It can be collected and it is done, but it's not as easy as blood collection.
Of course. And as I mentioned that sample, I think this is the moment we can go back to the pub quiz question that you asked in the beginning. Cerebrospinal fluid was not on the list, but others were. So as usual, if you can repeat the question to the listeners and then tell us what the answer is.
So my question was, which of the following more unusual biospecimen types are not stored at our biobank? Saliva, hair, sweat, fecal samples, nasal swabs, gastric content, or breast milk? And the answer was sweat. We do not collect and store sweat.
My favorite question, why not?
Just not.
I love that answer. You know, I was already expecting because, well, scientifically or whatever, just not. Okay, but actually, there are quite a few other samples that are interesting. Okay, saliva, I would assume so. Nasal swabs, we've heard so much about them because of COVID. But the gastric content. Why? Why are you interested in this?
It can be useful, for example, for diabetes. It can be useful when it's linked with the microbiome, which is also linked with the fecal sample. But it's true, fecal samples are much less invasive than gastric content. So yes, there is an interest, but it's not so often. Like I say, those are more unusual samples collected.
Yes, true. And the same goes with breast milk. But I think there's quite a lot of research going with breast milk, right? Still, even now.
I'm not so sure.
You're not so sure. I mean, I do know that breast milk is a fascinating sample to collect and to research for sure. It was really, really interesting to learn all about the samples today. IBBL is in Dudelange, right? But you can't just go and visit like this and see all the samples. It's only for the researchers.
So IBBL is in Dudelange and no, you cannot come and visit like this. We have sometimes open days where you are welcome to come and see your freezer and our liquid nitrogen tanks. But apart from that, no, you should first contact a researcher or project manager teams.
But as we're talking about collecting samples, definitely what we can say is that if you are interested in contributing, whenever there is a chance, whenever there is a call, whenever your clinician asks you to give some samples, please do, because this is so important for research and important for everyone for, you know, figuring out what is going on and helping a lot of people. So just, yes, do participate.
Exactly. I could not have said it better.
Thank you. So anyway, what remains right now is just to thank Kathleen for her very interesting stories today. And yes, hopefully we'll meet one day again. You'll have another fascinating study to tell us about.
Let's hope. Thank you for having me.
And this is it for today. Don't forget to subscribe, to follow us, to read what we are writing about on Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook. And yeah, follow Research Luxembourg as well, that as usual, remember, powers these episodes. And yeah, my name is Hanna Siemaszko, and this was SciLux.